Hello everybody, I'm Chris.
I'm Craig.
And I'm Jack.
And here we are back with the shadowy cabal of TV Cream for another commentary. A bit of a callback now, we've been doing this on our own for a few weeks now, a few months now, and we thought we'd involve somebody else, and we thought the natural thing to do would be get somebody from Coke Bridges into comic books again. But Martin couldn't be here, so we've had to make do with superstar Mark Miller.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So here we go.
So here we are with Step Twin Sunride again. We've already had the most beautiful intro ever from That Coen Presents.
Wow, that's an amazing print.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it?
So I just bought it on Amazon.
Right. So I didn't understand what the point of this running gag is. Is he shooting them to cook them? Is that what?
No, at the beginning, he's just trying to shut it up.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But there we are, already set up the relationship. Oh, constantly thwarted. Harold's trying to be a bit classy with the four-poster bed. So what's our memories of this, Mark? What's your memory of this film?
I remember being excited about this film because the first one contained nudity.
Yay.
A partial nudity. And that was a beautiful thing about the 70s, because whether it was a Sweeney or it was a comedy, especially if it was a TV spin-off, like the Love Thy Neighbour movie or something, it was always a sort of strip scene.
Yes.
Yep. So when you're 10 or 11 or something, then that pre-internet age, it was that or the Littlewoods catalogue.
That's right.
For the closest you could get to
Littlewoods, we were grattan, man. You were further up the hill than us.
It has an amazing cast, this.
It's funny
Cat Weasler in here.
Because since you're here, Mark, can I thank you from the bottom of my old man's heart for the Swedish princess bum at the end of Kingsman?
I have to say that was Matthew Vaughn.
Where's Matthew?
I have to throw that.
Phone Matthew.
Yeah, let's get
him. There's a very happy man in Glasgow.
That's actually how the movie originally ended. That was the end of the film. And Matthew
that's
had
the last
this gag
I remember
at the end, where you basically have the close-up on the girl's bum, and then you have Mark Strong closing the two sort of doors.
Does
over,
something
you know?
Happen after that? I mean, I'm not being facetious. I don't remember anything.
Then we added the Superman 2 ending onto it. Goes back and takes on the bully.
Right.
So, but originally it was just the doors closing and the end. And we were like, you can't end the film like that. It's so awful. It's great in a 1974 kind of way, but
I was crying in gratitude.
So here we're setting up where the characters are, because Harold can't get any dinner money, and Albert's saying, horse is more important than you are.
It looks lovely, doesn't it? It's a really good looking film.
I actually think it weirdly looks as if Jim Cameron's directed it. But I always find that CBS sort of high definition looking yard. You're so used to this sort of, you know, the stage, the BBC stage, aren't you? That's even it cuts the outdoors. It's like this cost $200 million.
I have to say, this is a terrible thing to say, really, about my late gran. But anybody watching this would know why I used to call her Steptoe.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
So why did you call her Steptoe?
Because that's what she looked
like. She looked like Wilfred Bramble.
Yeah. She didn't smoke horse shit and bus tickets.
My mate
Kent
Hugo,
is mild.
Not around the kids. Not around the kids.
Also looked like Wilfred Bramble.
And has anybody here met Wilfred Bramble?
It's
almost as if we discussed this before we started recording.
Now, weirdly, when I was about 14, my brothers and I were on holiday. They're much older than me. We were on holiday over in, I think it was like Magaluf or one of those kind of places, or Malaga or something, somewhere in Spain. Okay. And I was just happy because it was not sunny, then it was sunny, then it was not sunny again. I just remember going somewhere hot. And we were in the airport, and I saw a man in an impeccable white suit who looked really creepy.
Was he hanging about the toilet?
He was. Hanging around the toilet. And he just looked really creepy, you know, like the child snatcher and And one of my brothers went, oh my God, look at that guy, he's so creepy. Look at him. And he was just checking everybody out. And he was impeccably dressed. He looked like Dirk Bogart.
Is this at the airport in Spain?
At the airport in Spain. And we were heading, obviously, for Glasgow and wherever he was heading, you know, sort of Jersey.
A direct flight to
like
St. John's
Wood. But we saw him, and then we thought, oh my God, that stepped up. But the thing is, he was so clean shaven, it's a bit like Selwyn Froggitt. You know, like that guy in real life was always pretty nice.
Bill Maynard.
And likewise, Compo in Last of Summer Wine. He's always got a cravat on him.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
That's exactly what Wilfred Bramble was like as well. He looked impeccable.
Which, so he would have actually,
hide that face.
He would have actually looked like he does in Holiday on the Buses.
Exactly. Yeah. A bit of a gem.
He has a great graffiti, superb graffiti. Johnny J, the Odeon groper.
I liked lovely big tits Heather.
Now, the original Steptoe and Son film, I think this is the same tower block that Zita lived in with George Logan. Remember when they go up to the door? He goes up to the door to try and find her, and George Logan comes to the door, and he's like a drag artist. But George Logan, of course, being latterly one half of Hinge and Bracket.
Oh, right.
I think it's the same tower block, probably just round the corner from. Actually, probably not just round the corner from Elk Street or the Television Centre.
It's kind of like.
And that old woman was in quite a mess.
There was, you know, I used to often see when we were filming Kick-Ass or something, we were down at L Street, they had this reception area, as you can remember, you drove the car through as you were coming into the building, and I've now seen it in everything. It's in every TV spin-off movie, it's on the buses, it's even in the same as a continental checkpoint.
Did we not work out that the L Street reception is the reception in Life Force?
Yeah, I think so.
Because we did a commentary for Life Force, and we think it's absolutely beautiful in it. Yeah. It must be brand new.
Isn't Life Force the film with Glasgow Smiles Better?
Yeah. At the end of Life Force, when do you know Life Force?
I haven't seen it. I know that it's a canon film. Is that Debbie Harry? Is Debbie Harry?
What's her name? Matilda May.
Matilda May. Steve Rail's back.
Peter Firth and the late, sadly late now, Frank Finlay, as Dr. Hans Falada.
That's amazing. Best Van Helsing in history.
Absolutely.
At the end of it, it all goes mental and London's blowing up and everything. And in the background, there's a bus with a Glasgow Smiles Better.
Diana Dorr.
Driven by Pat Lally, I think.
Almost certainly.
Gene McFadden on the back.
Now, how much did they have to downgrade these locations to make them look suitable?
Probably not at all.
That's what I'm thinking. No, this clearly, I was thinking more of the exterior.
Oh, not at all.
And the graffiti and all that.
I think this
stuff
is exactly what the police looked like.
That's something I think we want to talk about. I mean, I remember cities looking like this.
Yeah. I remember flats that were like that.
Most of you here are from the West Coast. I'm from Edinburgh. Leith looked like that.
You spent 20 grand to make your flat.
My flat doesn't like that.
Yeah, but I remember, absolutely. That's
gap sites, old industrial units, pretty grotty housing.
Yeah, that is interesting because you don't really get sets that look that dirty. No. Don't you?
Yeah.
Even EastEnders or something that's supposed to be kind of grimy always looks kind of new.
Well, that's always been a classic TV cream trope, isn't it? People used to have talked about that for years, is that everybody in EastEnders is poor and used to use the laundrette, including millionaire.
Yes.
Would you call him from the
Wilmot Brown?
No, Spandau Valley that was in it.
Martin Kemp.
Even the posh guy.
Even he had to use it. Yeah.
The 80s yuppie guy.
Yeah. Michael Cashman.
No, remember the blonde guy? He had a double-barreled name.
Wilmot Brown.
From the Dagmar.
Oh, that was a bit of a sort of... That was a callback to Kingsman there. Did you see that?
But I always maintain in the sort of early to mid-80s, like, the TV world cleaned up. Because if you watch the first episode of EastEnders or Casualty, everywhere's horrible.
Oh,
and there's like loads of litter and junk. And now when you look at it, they're pristine places.
And
it's because they can't afford someone to come in and dust it up.
That's right.
And right inside.
Do you remember as a kid, though, you always kind of thought Diana Dors was supposed to be kind of sexy? But she was always about 10 or 15 years past being sexy.
Yeah, until
that in a weird way made her even sexier.
I'm with you on this.
Jack,
what you're saying is you like the MILF magic.
Jack, you know a story to do with TVAM about Diana Dors Slim Club, remember?
Oh, did she?
The Greg Dyke one.
Yeah, she...
With the calculator.
Yeah, she got done for product placement.
Yep.
She came on multiple episodes. They had Diana Dors doing a slimming thing, and basically what they didn't realise is that she was also trying to push... Was it a diet calculator?
It was a diet calculator, and it was basically a calculator.
Yes.
And she... Correct me if I'm wrong.
The sex parties.
Because you're taking too long.
Yeah, go on.
Right.
I
she appeared at the start.
Uh-huh.
They said that she said Greg Dyke, who was running at the TVNM, said don't plug that because you're not having
that's
that.
Right. Yeah.
And she did. Uh-huh. And then at the end of it, she'd lost all this weight. Well,
right.
She looked exactly the same, but she'd been wearing weights
when she went in at the start. Yes.
And then when they had the little calculator thing, and she said, but you can buy it from this address, and she gave them she said, write in with your check for $12.99 or whatever. And Greg Dyke said, no, we'll just keep all the money.
And he did?
Yeah. Because they were all made out to TVAM, and she was told not to punt it.
That's amazing. Did it go public? Did that story play?
I don't know, but I heard about it when Greg Dyke was pushing his autobiography. That's when he was talking about it.
I love this when he says, are you ever going to do in here with him? And he gives a wee smile, just thinking about it for a second.
So why is she in such a... Why is she not a bigger star in this? Like, where was she in her career?
Well, I mean...
Because this is her only scene, isn't it?
Hammer House of Horror.
right?
Yeah, this is 73.
That one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is 73. So
she's in Vault of Horror that year.
Yep.
No, From Beyond the Grave.
She's but the thing is, Dorsey after the sort of the big years, the rank starlet years, and all that, was always really just a jobbing actress.
Yeah. She's floating around. But you have to remember this would be quite a big film as well when it came out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because, I mean, I remember being stunned to hear around about 1970.
I love this. Sorry, just interrupt. See when she does this. What are you bleeding doing in that? Oh.
But you know, the 1977 One Diamonds Are Forever was number two at the box office to Holiday
on the Buses.
Brilliant. Wow. So there was an amazing loyalty from the TV over to the cinema, wasn't
Yeah, there? I think it's a really, really lazy arsed complaint when people say all the people did made in the 70s was film versions of sitcoms and they don't judge them on their own terms.
So
they just say they must inherently be rubbish.
Yeah.
And some of them are absolutely phenomenal, like
so
this.
Which is, apart from this then?
The Lightly Lads is a
great
fantastic one, which I always say is the better version of, you know that crap line in Forrest Gump, when he says, laugh like a box of chocolate.
Yeah.
Not, but in the accent. you never know what you're going to get, except if you look at the big card, it tells you. and in The Lightly Lads, if I get this right, he says, Terry says, life is like a box of chocolates where the top layer's gone and somebody's eating the orange cream off the bottom.
That is a good film, that. It's also got the 24 Hours to Falkirk.
So, Mark, do you have a favourite sitcom?
So, now he's killed. Now he's killed the chicken from next door because of no money for food. That was
right, okay, I'm with you. Right, so.
Mine, I've got so many. Uh-huh. And believe it or not, mine's are the slightly more lowbrow ones because this is a poignant one.
It is quite poignant.
This is like a play.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good film.
Yeah.
And likewise, Lightly Lads is like that as well, you know. But I think my favourite, the one that inspired me for my life, is Father Dear Father.
Why?
It just seems so cool. Like, I used to fancy the girls in it when I was
a Patrick really Cargo was a was
Patrick
a Cargo,
he's a god to me.
Yeah.
He's my favourite of all the number twos.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron Campbell's is the best prisoner episode.
Okay.
But on top of that, it just looked like the life of a writer looked amazing. He had this amazing house, glamorous office.
This is what
these two beautiful girls that I had figured out were his daughters
a
when I was a kid that I used to kind of fancy.
Sorry, that's my favourite line when he says, I had your dinner. And he looks at him and says, a Bombay shite hawk with a left more on it than that. But Father Dear Father, the film was directed by William G. Stewart.
I'm a massive William G. Stewart
fan. Good man.
I was into him pre-15-1, though, you know when you're a kid. Well, you
Price
know, when
right,
as a kid, you start noticing the same names on Things You Like. And it's kind of like a cultural awareness kicks in about 10.
Yeah,
and I used to notice, like, on things like Carry On Doctor, I see William G. Stewart's name in there with Patrick Cargill. So you're starting to see the connections of Things You Like on the scripts and stuff, you know? So, yeah, I've always loved
it. William G. Stewart's a great guy.
Yeah.
Is he still
alive? Yes,
he
certainly
is.
I think I'm being saying, sorry about this, William, if I'm wrong. I think he was brought up in Scotland in a quarry's home.
We're named like William G. Stewart,
Great guy. And there's all the fantastic Price is Right stuff.
Yeah, where he used to wear a Union Jack bomber jacket, didn't he?
Oh, no, it was a pink bomber jacket. Pink,
right.
Shiny bomber jacket.
Oh, yes, that's right.
We'd get them to sing, we'd get the audience to sing Land of Hope and Glory. And so that when they were all whipped up, they'd immediately just start the titles.
One of the most impressive things I saw this year was a friend of TV Cream's, Tony Curry, who's a pal of mine.
Oh, yes.
Was up at the house at Christmas time, and you know, we were having a big party in the house, there was a lot of people in. And we were talking with one of my friends, who's also a big TV Cream aficionado, and we were talking about Sally, the ex-wife of William G. Stewart, William G. Stewart, and he had texts from them both on his iPhone.
Oh, wow.
It's like from the previous 24 hours, you know, thanking them for a Christmas card or something.
Nice.
And I remember, for me, that's above Angelina and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, no, totally,
from
totally.
Sally Jason or something.
Wow.
You know, like, that's as good as it gets.
Jack, I wanted to ask you, as the resident official only Doctor Who fan in the room.
Proper Doctor Who fan.
Did you recognise who that was there, that was the vet?
It wasn't your man from Green Death, was it?
Well done.
Do you know what? Because I didn't recognise it yesterday, and it totally passed me by, but as soon as you asked me that question...
Clifford, isn't it?
Yeah, Clifford Jones.
Clifford Jones.
Yes, was the name of the character in the Green Death.
So as you point out, the story now is that the horse is, the Hercules is lame because it's walked back from York.
he climbed into a Pickford's lodge.
He fell asleep.
That image on the motorway is
incredible. That's great, isn't it?
And as you see as well, there's a bit of a callback on that later because the Pickford's van is yet another crucial plot point later on.
I think they made Steptoe slightly more rounded and nicer in this film.
What? This is a funny thing, actually.
Well, he doesn't. It's not very nice later on.
But you see all the
he's
way
nice to the animals.
all my life watching. They were asking, we started off, what was Move Off when you first saw that. And all my life I can remember Steps on the Sun, you know.
Yep.
Mum and Dad loved it, even though it was finished in about 74.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it was always on. I've never liked Harold. I actually only like Albert.
Really?
I think Harold's a bit of a cock.
I never liked any of them. I never liked
Harold. I like Albert. I think he's a great old guy.
Why?
Because he's actually quite sweet, really, and he's actually quite sentimental.
But
you must see,
though, that he's got a grip on him.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But
it's
still
the
like
ultimate tragedy, though. I mean, he loves him, but he wants to keep him in a box under his bed.
Could I also point out just this difference between Now and Then and London? So that's a rest home for horses in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
Later on is Southall Market, which is a horse market in London, which was a market. They filmed there, sort of contemporaneously. None of that exists now.
Well, Southall will probably just all be the Sharp now or something, won't
it? Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. 80 quid.
But I remember watching, you know, the 70s...
That was a remarkable growth.
The 70s documentary, The Family.
Yeah.
And they used to have a couple of scenes with the... there was like the... dodgy prospective son-in-law, the guy with the big tash.
Oh, yeah.
And they used to have scenes of him in the pub. Literally, it's just like sawdust on the floor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Just an absolute dump.
And actually, that's what the house in the family looks like.
Yeah.
The family does look like this.
It's actually not
it's the
as well appointed as that.
Yeah.
That's a nice room, that.
Yeah. I find that series really scary.
There's that great bit when the kid chokes and the dad, Trevor, his name, tips him upside down and batters him on the back until he comes out. Here's Southall Market.
Yeah.
Here we go. Watch the faces in this.
That's
again, look how beautifully shot it is.
Coldbridge Main Street, Haymark.
Yeah.
Well, not now.
The director
actually,
Peter Sykes also made a Hammer film called Demons of the Mind.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is really good. Robert Hardy's in it.
We were actually watching Dr. Terror's House of Horror.
Oh, yeah.
Which I hadn't watched since I was a kid. It'd been a long time. But the idea of Roy Castle and a film with Donald Sutherland. You know, and Kenny Lynch being in it and all that. You know,
Alan Freeman.
This is good. Alan Freeman being on that train. I can't remember him even being in it first time.
And Roy Castle does a great comedy Jamaican accent in it.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
that's probably why he's never been on television.
You just met my son before we came here. Before Christmas, over Christmas, I did, I curated, as they say these days, a whole series of Amicus and horror films, two a night, for about a week, and it was just brilliant.
Which one did you like best?
Probably From Beyond the Grave.
Even more than Vault of Horror.
Yeah.
Vault of Horror's mad.
I love Vault of Horror.
I think Vault of Horror is wonderfully trashy.
Yeah. But that ending of the Tom Baker one is
it's great.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
So here they are, they're buying a horse.
Well, you're coming back for the Vault of Horror one then, Mark. That's
Oh, you got that coming up?
Oh, I think we'll always
now
certainly
we
will. Oh, no, we've always planned to do Vault of Horror. If only because I want to point out yet again that I want to live in Terry Thomas's house. Leather Trilby, beautiful.
So
but this is the thing about the relationship, because he won't let him go away and buy the horse on his own.
Yeah.
But he's right.
But it's quite sweet.
Do you think
he's proven right?
I wonder if the second one was focus group.
It's Frankie Barra.
Well, the first one they're saying, the father is not very popular in
maybe.
The north and southeast.
Yeah.
Maybe
so
he
should
soften
a bit.
Do you think,
rough edges,
do you think those are the conversations they had in Anglo EMI?
They must have produced this quite quickly, though, because the first one was just 72, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
they used to. 73.
You've got a theory about the title, Chris.
Yeah, because this is Stepped on Sunride again, and in 72.
God, remember him, that foxy looking
words
guy?
And
he used
pictures.
To
Henry Wolfe.
Henry Wolfe. And in 72 was The Magnificent Seven ride again. Hence, I think, the title.
Yeah,
right.
Gotcha.
I looked up Henry Wolfe yesterday. He's still alive. He's
phenomenal
86.
Actor.
Which means he's actually relatively young there.
He'd have been about 42. Wow. He was a big pal of Harold Pinter's and was the first person to produce a Pinter play.
And he looks not unlike Pinter.
Absolutely. They grew up in Hackney together.
Yeah.
Very smart guy. He ended up becoming like professor of theatre at the University of Saskatchewan, and which is where he lives now.
Now, I pointed out earlier on, I'll go over this again, that the whole Frankie Barra thing is a callback to the series. There's an episode called The Seven Steptori, where Frankie Barra turns up to run a protection racket.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, we're not going to pay you, whatever, and he comes back a week later. The conceit of it is that Albert has been going in the afternoon with his pals to the pensioner shows of Kung Fu films.
Yeah.
And when Frankie Barra and all them come back the next week, they go all Kung Fu on them.
Oh, I remember that one.
And one of the, another callback for this, one of the crowd of old guys that was beating people up is Vic Armstrong.
No way.
He must have watched
Glasgow
last Armstrong.
Week.
Yeah.
Wow.
So Frankie Barra's a sort of returning trope.
That's a
Hercules the second.
So you know you were talking about Harold Pinter there.
Yeah.
So my fact about an obscure connection. Do you know the fact about Andre the Giant? There's a particular fact about who Andre the Giant knew. There's a connection.
Oh yes, yes, that's right. Yeah.
No, to somebody else. Which is, come on, Chris. Can you remember?
Samuel Beckett.
Yeah. Andre the Giant used to get driven to school by Samuel Beckett.
No way.
Yes.
True.
Seriously.
Fact.
This is a fact.
My mind's reeling trying to figure the connection.
I know. It's mad, isn't it?
Paris, and Samuel was his neighbour.
That dog is a great dog.
The size of
no, exactly.
This is it. See, this whole scene is cracking.
You can tell Chris loves this film because he's talking about it much.
Oh, everything about it is beautiful. I mean, that dog is so well.
That's exactly our kitchen unit when I was a kid.
Oh, wow. I know.
It's the look of his face when he makes this tea.
Do you know what I think? Well, I think in the 70s, there was just less stuff.
Yeah.
I think there's less stuff. So now we've got this amazing international's availability of everything. You know, you can come from any country.
Yeah.
Whereas everybody sort of bought their stuff in MFI or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know the TV Cream toy thing?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, Phil Norman.
Everybody has a connection to all those toys. Whereas I think if you bring something like that out now, kids won't have a clue because there's a billion
there's lots of different permutations of everything as well.
There was five toys or something. Yeah.
But that's the same as what we say about films back when this was a proper country. Yeah. Now, that's not a Farage kind of thing to say. The point we make is that up until about the late 80s, all of us would have watched the same sort of films as our parents and actually our grandparents.
Yeah.
So we all had this shared dialogue,
100%.
You know, where everybody knew who Will Hay was.
You and I also talked about this because of watching Russ Abbott's. We're watching a Russ Abbott Saturday Mad. Abbott Show Christmas special.
Christmas
in the
80s. Madhouse,
And saying as a kid, you know, remember he did the two. Him and Les Dennis did the two spibs.
Yeah,
I understood what a spib was.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You all got that.
You've got historical awareness. There's something very interesting. I find it in film quite a lot now as well, which is that people tend not to get references. A general mainstream audience is anything before the year 2000.
Really?
It's not even the 90s.
That's amazing.
Like the 90s is your mum and dad, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but the year 2000 is kind of the cutoff. Anything before Hannah Montana isn't really that.
And
I know what happened is it's just the multiplication of possibility. Nobody opted for 70s, 60s, 50s, and certainly not Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas because we only had the three possibilities on TV as channels, we watched
that's the thing though.
Because when they've come up with it, when they came up with all the different channels and they did, you know, Turner did that deal with all the MGM catalogue and all that, shifted it all onto TCM. Now all films are ghettoised into film channels.
Yeah.
And if you look back at, if you look back at schedules in the '80s, even the late '80s, I mean, you'd have, you know, George Formby films on it.
Yeah.
Well, half past five on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah. BBC Two.
That's
what
I
show loads of stuff. Yeah.
And it's the summer holidays, so you know, we'll stick on some Laurel Hardy in the morning.
And that was actually a proper education.
Oh yeah, it's a broad awareness.
Yeah.
Like Buster Crab, Flash Gordon, all that stuff. That for me, that was, even though school wasn't on, that was school. You know, like that taught me everything I needed to know.
Sorry that Hercules II just pissed up Albert's leg.
So
White City.
Enormous. Is that where the
BBC
is now?
So the Buster Crab stuff, I can see how that's turned up in some of your work.
Yeah.
But is there a lot of stuff from the '70s that you feel like you can't find a place for or reference for?
I'll always find something. Like in terms of big
Jelly
budget
babies.
Stuff from big movies, Spy Who Loved Me, you know, Flash Gordon, you know, that sort of era, Star Wars, Superman.
Yes.
Like for me, like my sort of culturally forming years are probably 74 to about 82, around about then. Like almost everything I love comes and sort of relates
what
to that.
A Swatch Shop era. That's what you're
I was a Swatch Shop kind of like, even though we were working
that's
class, I was a Swatch Shop.
Posh, I always think it goes on class like.
We were very aspirational.
But do you find that there's a bit of your hinterland that there is no place for in the stuff that you do, or do you think that you can
get
all that stuff in?
I'll get a reference. I've made references to Father, an American comics.
Have you?
Brilliant.
There one where you think, I'm really pleased I got that in, and like no one's ever spotted it?
I think a couple of things, like can't remember off the top of my head, but things like alien names, I've got something in there, you know, like Donald Sinden or something like that.
Sweet.
And they're in a Green Lantern.
An alien Donald
Sinden.
I'm going to destroy the
But you'll do Donald with a D8N, just to make it seem a bit more alien or something. Yeah.
I had totally forgotten this, but I'd mentioned, I'm not really into comic books at all, never have been, just not my thing.
This guy writes comics?
No,
sorry, is that me? But talk about references that that mean nothing to you. We used to go to Millport a lot. And in the sort of mid-80s, in the Kames Cafe, which we subsequently bought in a genius business stroke, Ferdy that owned it, for some reason...
Ferdy Righetti.
For some reason, the guy that... he started selling, because they had a little shop next to it. You know, cafes would always have like a little something. And he started selling American comics, and there would be things like Richie Rich,
right,
and Sad Sack, and things like that.
Those weird ones only soldiers and a war would read.
You're really totally bizarre. So then so anyway, we just get a copy of it, and it would have all those adverts in it for like Hostess Devil Food Cakes and Twinkies and things.
Did they have the fish with the human heads?
What?
They used to get ads in a lot of those comics. You could buy. You must remember that. I get them in the packet.
I sent off for a lot of
things.
Did you? Yeah.
Did you get those though?
There was one thing but I was obsessed with, and it was a hover car, a real life hover car.
Somebody explain the fucking fish with the human head.
You could buy. So hang on, finish the thing about the hover car, and then we'll come back to the
those big things
heads.
In American comics. You'd always get one page, and it would be like 40 ads all squeezed in. And back then, it was quite hard to buy stuff abroad. You know, you'd go and get American dollars and send it off and everything. But there was this thing that said, impress your friends. And it was a photograph of a wee guy looking at this thing that was a classic Doctor Who looking sort of hover device, right?
Right.
It was three, like, orbs with, like, three poles between them and a seat on top of it. And it looked like some amazing anti-gravity device that the BBC would have made, kind of thing.
Right.
And there's a kid, 70s kid, looking around at it like, this is amazing. And it said, impress your friends, fly around your house, fly around your school, you know, we'll fly up to 150 feet in the air. And I was like, and I thought it was like $9.99. And I was like, this is the most, I've
get
got
two.
It. And I remember going to the bank, saving up pocket money, going to the bank, getting $10, sending it off. And counting down the days, like thinking about it in school and all that, coming back. And then it arrived, and I thought there was something wrong when I saw some postmarks Wisconsin or whatever, you know, but it was in an A4 envelope, right? And I opened it up. And what it was the blueprints for one of these devices.
Oh,
and
that's
one of the ingredients
shocking.
To make it was an anti-gravity disc. And everything else was just like whooping off. An anti-gravity disc.
No, I'm sorry, I need to point out, this is an absolutely spectacular sequence.
It's a lovely...
it's
purchase.
The wonderful Welsh actor.
The fantastic...
Clifford...
not Clifford.
No, I'm thinking of the guy from...
Oh, that's terrible. Anyway, he's in Bottle Boys.
Yes.
it
was
just
Bottle Boys the last sitcom that had a cartoon opening?
I posed this question when
question,
he died, because he died just very recently. And it may well be.
It probably is, because it's about 10 years later than it should have been Bottle Boys.
Oh, no, totally.
It's
totally.
It was out in 84, 85.
But this whole thing about you, buying it has the greatest payoff line. Look, now, can I just also point out? Look at that butcher shop. Absolutely beautiful.
It is beautiful.
Sawdust.
Picture of the happy animals.
And there they are hanging up behind them.
You've got your classic 70s battle axe behind there.
Yep. Now, that if anything, the only thing that could have made this any better is if that had been played by John Sutherland.
Yeah. Do you know how
but
much
this
you
is
bought
the,
that for?
This is the great line. 37.5p, because it's £2.50 to start. It's the great line there where he says, I hope you enjoy it. So he says, it's not for me, it's for the dog.
Now, Bottle Boys is London Weekend Television.
Yeah,
it
sure
that's,
was.
That's right, because John Burt...
Acton Park.
Says, what's that?
Acton Park.
Oh, yes. John Burt, in his autobiography, The Harder Path, talks about that. And bitterly regrets having commissioned it.
Yeah, he's
a... regrets having commissioned it?
Yeah.
I guess it was 2 years into Ben Elton and things by that point,
yes,
wasn't
it was,
so they were probably slightly...
Well, that was a great trade-off, then.
You can see the... this sort of training montage, you can see the effect it had on Rocky.
So this is meant to be Acton Park, and just brilliantly for London, in the background was one of the headquarters of one of the Worshipful Companies.
Oh,
that
yeah.
With the portico at the front, it was the Worshipful Company of, I don't know,
so
ginger bottles or something.
Can I just do some admin
do.
Here? So you could send away for what they advertised were little fish with human heads, and they sent them to you in a packet.
Were those
sea monkeys?
Sea monkeys. I remember
they got them as well.
There was
a
little king one. Was there not a little one that was like a king?
Did they have little human heads?
Yeah.
They're lice,
though,
aren't they?
They're sort of sea lice.
Basically lice, aren't they?
Yeah.
No, they're actually amazing because they can survive in almost anything. You put them into water and they're like tiny silver luminescent tadpoles. But
nice. There
is a weird magical quality to them.
Was there anything you didn't buy?
This is him starting to steal his pigeons.
Well, you couldn't see. You couldn't really prove they didn't because they were really absolutely
right.
Tiny.
Did one have a crown on though?
Wow. And what was the last of these sort of lineage of sitcom spin-offs? Because I always regret there was never a Never the Twain movie or Duty Free movie.
Can you imagine? Well, but the thing is, the last Duty Free Christmas special is basically a film.
It is, yeah.
But they started doing that with Only Fools and Horses, started doing that as well. They'd have feature length.
That's true, yeah.
That Miami Twain
stuff
is
shit. Things like In-Betweeners and
everything. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. And you know what's amazing? And I was astonished at this. I think it made something like, I can't remember if it was £19 million in Britain or $19 million.
The In-Betweeners.
The In-Betweeners movie made in cinemas, which is like crazy money. That's like,
it's
big
the,
action.
It's the most successful British comedy film now ever.
Yeah. And, but what's amazing is we think that loyalty ended in 1974, but weirdly that TV loyalty.
Absolutely.
Well, you had Porridge in 79. You had
that's
Rising
a great
Damp.
Film.
Yes. Yeah.
That's not so good.
That's not good, because that is basically just three
episodes. No, because Richard Beckinsale had died by that time, so it's Christopher Strolling.
And I do like him, but
I like
just,
he's
but
no Richard Beckinsale.
I was comparing him.
He was good in Only When I Laugh, wasn't he?
I really love that.
I've never seen Richard Wilson in.
Which I think is Eric Chappell.
Yes, it is,
Quite scary title sequence, How Anyone Laugh. That used to really just...
I'm H-A-P-P-Y.
That was on at like 7 o'clock on a Monday night.
Yeah, it was horrible.
It was a big, big show.
But I reckon that all of us here have... None of us has fallen into the gap of saying that ITV sitcoms were shit.
No, in the
70s, ITV pissed all over the BBC and sitcoms.
I would agree. You know, I think the BBC was actually better written. I think it was a bit more like this.
Well, maybe, but in terms of popularity,
but see, just for crowd pleasing, if you're seven.
Oh yeah,
and your Rise and Damp and all that's incomparable. Only When I Laugh is.
And there was no bigger sitcom in the 70s than On the Buses. It was the biggest sitcom of the 70s.
I think that's the thing I'm most obsessed with. All the sitcoms, actually.
Of On the Buses? I love On the Buses.
Really?
Yeah.
I think
it was LWT's...
Audio On the Buses will be coming on at some point.
On the Buses was LWT's most successful sitcom until Mind Your Language.
Mind
Your Language is more successful.
But that bumped it down or bumped into the 80s?
Yes, it did. Yeah. I'm saying it was LWT's most successful sitcom.
My favourite Mind Your Language fact is one of the guys... is in Indiana Jones film.
That's right, yeah, Indiana Jones.
And he's one of that, in that chase in the first
that's
act.
That's right, yeah.
You know, he's part of that secret brotherhood who saves Indy, you know.
He has that rather wry smile that goes for more than two centuries.
Oh, yes, of course, yes, so it is. Yeah. It's not the Spanish guy with the leather jacket.
No, he was good though, wasn't he?
He was my favourite.
Was he in, he wasn't in Juicy Free, was he, that guy?
There's
a lot of respect for Duty Free here.
Yeah, I love
Duty
Free. I think there's something weird though. I think I'd sort of decided that I didn't like 80s stuff.
Right.
You know, and I was already feeling nostalgic about the 70s by the time I was about 14 or 15. And I remember Duty Free starting, and a lot of my friends been into it, and I was like,
well,
it's not quite Terry and Joe.
But then I had that thing about Duty Free that I had with a couple of shows in the 80s, which I thought was so good that I thought it must be a repeat of an older series.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I would like it now because the actual quality of the people in it
it's
such a classic British idea as well. The expats and all that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I wish I'd given it more due.
You just mentioned there about Decreasing Circles. I watched the box set of that a couple of years ago, and I don't think as a teenager I had realised just how melancholy it is. It's a really genuinely lovely bit of writing.
Even the title is
it's incredible,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep.
And of course Stanley Libor's in it, who turns up in Superman 4.
And Flash Gordon.
And Flash Gordon, yeah. He plays Nelly.
Getting off with
Nella
Moody.
Yeah,
yeah.
Flash Gordon, we watch most days as well.
He's
bringing those kids up right now.
Flash Gordon.
Amazing soundtrack as well.
Yeah. I saw that in the cinema.
I like the fact my 4-year-old daughter knows who Deep Roy is.
Fantastic. I used to work with somebody in the BBC who's a cousin or niece of Deep Roy.
Really?
No way.
Yeah.
You can't imagine these guys having a life where they have families and things. They should just be on the set.
We were recording this in our usual location and not in the hospital where we all work, you'd see my big giant Flash Gordon poster up there.
Oh really? Is it is it that fold out one you got as a magazine? As a
No. It's a quad poster.
Where'd you get that from?
Oh, I don't know. Some dick gave me it.
Yeah,
I love all this. This is fantastic. This line when he says when he looks at the jacket, and he says that is the style set of 8 straight up the back, as worn by John Mills and Ryan's daughter.
That's a great line.
And just the way she goes, oh.
It's funny that thing about how he describes. So when
love
I was
the
at
pair
school, when I was a 6 year at school, we all went through a thing which was about 88, 89 of being obsessed with Quadrophenia. And it's the great bit when Leslie Ash says to him,
"Oh yeah,
what's his name? Phil Daniels." He goes, "I've been picking up my new suit," and she says, "Oh, what's it like?" And he goes, "Three buttons, 16-inch bottom, side vents, dark brown." And she says, "Oh, lovely."
Now, I seem to remember us on a previous commentary talking about your haunts in Edinburgh and things, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first place you went to.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you, Mark, is what was the first proper comic shop that you went to? And how did you find out that it existed?
Well, it's funny, being into comics before, certainly before 1988, and maybe even before the year 2000,
mm-hmm.
there was a quiet shame to it. You know, like your love of it had to be hidden, you know, and to survive school or whatever, you know. You had to kind of, I wore it on my sleeve a little bit, you know, but most people it would be pretty underground. So people didn't really admit it, and especially adults. I remember we had an English teacher who's a really cracking guy, I really liked him. And I remember I had some Batman or Superman thing or something on my desk, and he went, "Oh, do you like comics?" And I was like, "Yeah." He says, "A pal of mine who used to be an English teacher has given it up and opened up a comic shop in Glasgow called AKA Books and Comics." And it was in the Virginia Galleries. And I was like, "What do you mean a shop that just sells comics?" I was about 13. It was
when was this?
1983.
Right.
So, and I was like, "A shop that just sells comics?" And he was like, "Yeah." And I was like, "I have to go and see this, you know." And I went into Glasgow, which was a big deal, you know, headed into Glasgow on a Saturday.
On the blue train.
It was like a wonderland just walking in, and it was like comics all the way around, because it would just be a spinner rack and a cafe usually, you know. And it was only that month's comics you would know.
The King's Cafe in Millport,
like that classic Scottish kind of thing, you know. And like, but this was a shop that is completely full of comics and old comics. And I remember my pocket money used to just cover that month's comics. So then I had to find other cash. It became a sort of obsession. I had to try and find money, ginger bottles, anything I could get.
Can you remember what your first haul was from AKA then? Can you remember, like,
the first thing I ever bought?
Yeah. When you'd finished. When went there for the first time, walked out the door.
I was obsessed with Superman at the time, so I can't remember exactly, but I know it would be a classic Superman comic because I had that month's Superman comics from Coke Ridge, like the Rainbow Cafe and these places in Coke Ridge. But what I did was I saw maybe a 1970s comic. And what was really amazing was back in the day, comics used to come in very sporadically. You'd get part one of a story, then you'd wait 4 years for part two. And then
that was very sporadic.
Oh, it was unbelievable because it used to be ballast on ships. There was
but
no real
fucking good at that.
So it was very often you would maybe have a three-part story you were missing a part of. So I think it was probably like a Superman story I was missing a part of from 5 years previous, like that kind of thing. But it was amazing, and that's where all my money went for my teenage years.
How long was AKA Comics now?
It was there till about 1990.
Oh, right.
Because
I used to have a shop in Virginia Gardens.
What was
called?
That?
Trip Clothing.
Oh, that was in there at the same time.
Yeah,
like Obelisk Books
on the right,
and Trip Clothing and Rat Records. They were all
there. Was also
and there was the,
do you remember Spectrum?
There was the Anarchist Bookshop as well.
That's right.
I once bought a calendar there called Cat Lovers Against the Bomb.
There was a shop at the bottom there called Spectrum as well.
I don't even know where Virginia Galleries was.
It was by Marks and Spencer. And there was like some controversy. Marks and Spencer.
Off
Argyle
Street, the big giant one.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Virginia Street up the side.
Yeah. It's like the car park fell in on it or something.
Do you know that? Sorry, non-Glasgow people. Yeah. Well, fuck it.
We
you
all
know that. You know that big gold sign that's like Jacobean corsetry that's on the right? It's there. It was just down from there.
Okay.
No, because what I remember about Spectrum was going in there, and the guy who ran it, I remember he was talking to some kids, and he said, "Do you know what? I could engineer a craze for Space Rangers." That's what he said.
Wow.
I can engineer a craze for Space Ninjas.
See, I was lucky because I wasn't really a big comic book fan. Although, yours are good, Mark. But I had the science fiction bookshop in West Cross Causeway, which was just along from the Odeon Cinema. We talked about this on one of the previous ones.
That's where I was.
And that was
a nice
kind of mixture of the two things.
I think it became Forbidden Planet.
It did, and then they moved. Because it went from being one shop that sold comics and books on one side of the road, then it split, so all the comics were in one and all the paperbacks were across the way.
Yeah.
And then it became Forbidden Planet. But the guy who ran the bookshop now has a science fiction bookshop on Candlemaker Row in Edinburgh.
Oh,
just going down to the grass market.
Oh, I'd love to see it. You know,
it's a really good place. Just down from Greyfriars, Bobby.
Oh, I have to check it out, because what I was going to say is I missed that world of 70s sci-fi books.
Well, it's a good place for that.
I don't know anybody who even really reads sci-fi books anymore, and I'm in that world.
Yeah.
But you know, at school there'd always be somebody with a Ray Bradbury paperback or something.
Yeah,
that was classic.
Yeah.
But,
definitely.
Anyway, bracket films.
Bracket films, sorry.
There's a wee touch of Jeremy Corbyn about Steptoe.
Corbyn's Britain. See the so now just to recap, they've put all the money on Hercules II with some excellent tic tac work going down. Which in at the T-Pens, remember that?
Yeah, Paul Honey.
Chris Sell, we had to learn how to do tic tac.
Oh, right.
I don't suppose they bother with that anymore. Anyway,
yeah.
Mobiles.
No.
Corbyn's Britain. So, they've blown all the money, and now what are we going to do?
Look how the shape of that behind him matches his head, where the mirror's gone.
No, there was something you picked up on earlier, Craig, before we started this, which was it actually looks like they filmed this in a house, because the layout is completely different from the house from the series. In the series, you would come through the yard, through the door, stairs to the left. There was a little sort of entrance hall, then you went through to the living room. And in this, you come through the door, and then there's a toilet on the right, inside toilet as well. Stairs to the left, and then you
it's
go through and down,
yeah.
And there's a big room. So it's totally different, which makes you think that they might actually have filmed this on a location.
I don't want to spoil the magic, but I do reckon that's a set.
Yeah?
I reckon
because
that's a set.
I think what's happened is their original location was all smashed up. Or something, and they've just rebuilt it, but not bothered about continuity as such, because you never quite see out of these windows.
Yeah.
They've just got a slight
angle.
Oh,
yeah, that's true.
And
yeah.
There's just a light to one side there, I think.
But the actual location from outside of the yard,
that's
what
you'll say.
The thing that strikes me now
oil drum
is how much would that be worth in London now as a bit of property?
Yeah.
That's the weird thing, like, these two guys would actually be loaded.
I remember a guy I worked with as a gardener after I left school before I was going to university, and a guy called Ernie was a brilliant bloke, and he was from London. And this was in 1989. It's an old tin of tuna or something.
It's like a tin of metal polish or something.
And I remember Ernie saying that he'd sold his house in London 10 years previously, about 1979-80, for £19,000, and he used to say, "I can't even look at a paper for that area." It was a terraced house in sort of East London. You know, he was just
but thinking
absolutely
the size of the
gobsmacked.
Yard,
absolutely.
Do you think there's potential? You know, they're doing Are You Being Served now as a remake.
Yes.
Is there potential?
Well, no.
Futuristic version of this where they're loaded and the dad's dead and he's just a landlord.
But what would they do? And they wouldn't even. But you couldn't have that site. You couldn't have that sort of business or you know, it would be that thing where they do
no,
it for
but
the
I
same offer and
they've sold it up.
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
It should
but
be like Grace and Favour.
But Grace and Favour.
I love Grace
and
Favour.
It's a genuinely great series.
But it should be like that, I think, where it's just almost
just move somewhere
to do
else.
It's just that he sold the place, got a ton of cash for it, and he's now got an organic farm and stuff.
But there are inherent dangers as well about doing the same thing, because there's that new version of Open Allowers.
Yes.
Which is. It's all right, but it's pointless.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Granville is now like Arkwright.
Yeah.
You think, well, but what's the point of that? Because Granville would not. I suppose the jokes might be that he's turned into Arkwright. But,
yes.
But
it's
going
to hold the prisoner, isn't it?
But surely
he is number one.
Surely the comedy would be him being Granville and being in charge of the shop and then all the scrapes that get in him. But
it's like Superman Returns. It's essentially just a remake.
It's just a remake.
Yeah.
But the thing about the. The thing about Are You Being Served coming back is that I used to work in the department store, and up until the early 2000s, it was just still like Are You Being Served.
That's what I wanted to
but now it's just not.
No, but Fraser's is still a bit like that.
It's not. That's where I worked.
From the outside, it looks like
no,
that.
But inside, it still was. When I worked there, it still
is
was
it
like that.
Yeah.
It's totally different.
What was
your
job at Fraser's? No, hang on a second. Yeah. What do you think his job was at Fraser's?
Artist.
No.
Oh, okay.
I was there for 10 years, but only seasonally.
Oh, Santa?
Mm.
Ah, nice.
You made a documentary about him.
Seriously?
Yeah.
What years were you there?
1999 to 2008.
It's amazing.
Anyway, it was all still like
you used
that.
To argue with the kids over which was the best Star Wars film.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't, because I just told them it was Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I've got a bone.
That's not
answer.
An argument.
Yeah,
I've got a bone to pick with Santa.
Okay,
we
true.
Went.
She needed something as new.
we went to see Santa on Christmas Eve, which is a big mistake.
Wow.
And
we
like,
never used to open on Christmas Eve.
Well, it was a garden centre. We were at one just a couple of months back.
Sure,
and like, it was actually amazing. It was really good. But the big mistake was that the children all sat down and said to Santa what they wanted,
It was a bit late in the day.
Yeah, it was too late. And they came up with this stuff we'd never heard of. Santa, not being political, said, that's fine, I'll bring everything
demand. You know what? You know why that is?
This was at 5 to 6.
I'll tell you exactly why that is. Because we never used to open on Christmas Eve because they used to take the staff away to set up for the Boxing Day sale.
Oh, I see. Like Garden Centre.
But the what happens is you get so fucked off by the end of your run that when the people come in, you just go, aye, that's fine.
Well, the kids were all like,
whatever they want, aye, that's fine. Because there's no, frankly, on Christmas Eve, there's no comebacksies. Slam away.
You're here three months later, sitting with us complaining about it.
where's Santa's having a great old time? Somewhere.
And you can't even identify the guy who was...
Can I bring up something about the film, though? There's this whole thing now about the dad's insurance policy.
Yes.
Because he realises he's got an insurance policy for £1,000.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, a recurring theme of these commentaries is my obsession with the economy.
The economy. How does that economy work?
So, the £1,000 in this film is worth about £8,500. But at one point later on, he talks about using it to move away to Cornwall or something.
Yeah, but you could have probably still bought a house for that. So this is where things start to really kick off, because the immensely great Milo Shea is just about to appear.
Oh, yeah.
I once met Milo Shea in Glasgow.
Where at?
In some...
In Fraser's?
No. It was even ropier sounding than that. It was in a hotel.
All right.
It was when they were punting the film version of Pocoon, the Milligan novel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And not a bad wee film. But
Jim Dale, wasn't it?
That was the Adolf Hitler, My Partner's Downfall. That was from the '70s. No, this is only about 15 years ago, and they were doing a sort of publicity tour, and they did like a charity premiere in town and all that. Anyway, I blagged my way into it on the TV Cream ticket, and I found myself sitting in a sort of hotel suite bedroom with Jane Milligan and Terry Ryan, the director, and Milo O'Shea.
Right.
And I was there ostensibly to interview them for some piece that I was going to write. I just wanted to meet Milo O'Shea. And we sat chatting for about 2 hours. And the guy who was the producer kept on coming in and complaining that we were taking up too much time. But Milo O'Shea had forgotten he'd been in this.
Mm-hmm. Was he drunk when he did it then?
The thing is, he's been in literally hundreds of films.
Yeah, he's been in the West.
And I acted out all the scenes for him.
He is great in it.
Did you remember it once you brought it up?
Yeah. I certainly enjoyed it.
Ah, he's fantastic in it.
He's great. Dr. Popperwell.
and he only died just a few years ago. It wasn't that long ago. Because he was in the West Wing.
He's a guy that's been old forever, though.
Well, I have this thing about people who... Jason Robards is another one.
Yeah.
He got old, young, and then stayed that age for 40 years.
So Martin, I saw Steve Martin on Comedians in Cars getting coffee. With Jerry Seinfeld. And he looks the same as he did in 1982.
Yeah.
It's the same as he is.
Old dude.
Well, as soon as his hair went totally like grey, white grey, he just looks the same. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Who was the other one we put in that category?
Oh, there's loads of
Frank
Charles Wheeler, Frank Finlay, Alan Wicker, as well.
William Holden.
William Holden.
Yeah.
Because we're saying that the woman too, and that he's only about 50.
Yeah.
Late 50s.
Yeah. Alan Wicker, when he was doing Wicker's World down in 1978, was 25.
That's what a blazer does to you.
This is fantastic, all this stuff.
So Mark, one of Craig's obsessions, as he mentioned earlier on, is the economy within certain films.
Yeah.
And you just pick fault in it, don't you?
Don't understand how economies work.
Well, especially the Temple of Doom.
The Temple of Doom, yeah, we couldn't work that out.
At the start of Temple of Doom, where they get in the plane, and it's the cargo plane, and they fly away, and all it's carrying is some melons and a chicken.
How much does that keep you awake at night when you're doing your stuff and you're thinking, I don't know how they're balancing the books on that one?
Do you know, weirdly, I actually am so obsessed with those kind of details that I don't think I've ever had a mistake, except once in the 90s when I was writing The Flash, and I had the wrong amendment. I had this amendment I called the 22nd Amendment or something. Uh-huh. And it was just as the internet was starting mm-hmm. to become a thing, uh-huh. around about 1997. And I remember having, within minutes, 200 complaints.
Do you want to take the opportunity to apologise?
To each and every one of their complaints.
Why have we got this clown just coming out with shit like that? Yeah.
Do you know what? I just remembered, actually, speaking of Ari being served, a recent obsession of mine has been the Australian version of Ari being served. Really good, isn't
it? I was
ready to hate it. And one of my friends who I was telling you guys about earlier, John Wilson, who'll probably be listening to this, he made me a CD about 10 years ago that had the John Humphrey, the Mr. Humphreys singing that intro tune.
Oh, yeah.
You heard that? And I never knew where it was from. And he didn't quite know either. He just found it online somewhere. And I found out that's where it was from. I think it's very underrated.
So here's a question, right?
I've got one too.
From Are You, but I'm talking about Are You Being Served now.
No.
So
but
from,
it comes off
from
it.
Are You Being Served, who's your favourite character?
And Are You Being Served?
Yeah.
That's tricky.
You can have two.
They are all brilliant. It's the same. What's your favourite organ in your body? I think you need them all. You need them all.
Yeah, but you need some more than others.
That's true. Do you know, funnily enough, as a kid, I didn't appreciate Captain Peacock. I didn't pick up on his subtle sleaziness.
You've got a cheat coming up
stiff,
later, mate.
You know?
Yeah,
I didn't know that he was
trying
to get off with Miss Brahms.
Yeah,
I didn't catch that as a character.
Oh,
right,
He tries to get off with Mrs. Slocum a couple of times, too.
Yeah, but that's definitely his plan.
And there's all the stuff with the secretaries and Mr. Rumble's room and all that.
Oh, amazing.
No, the reason I ask is, what about you?
My question was, if you can remember John Inman singing that song,
yeah,
can you remember and sing the other soundtrack to
Yes, I can.
Go on in.
It's Take a Letter, Mr. Jones.
Can you sing it?
And it's because he's saying a lot of random words.
Take a letter, Mr. Jones. Even on the telephone, I'm a model secretary.
Rula Lenska, I remember. Again, so much of my sitcom memories
are
found somebody that was 13 years too old for me. Rula Lenska. I had a big crush on
her. Yeah, this is when he says, there must be something you can do. He says, well, I can't think of anything offhand. No, the reason I ask is because it's the lazy thing to talk about Mrs. Slocum and Mr. Humphreys.
Yeah.
When actually my favourite characters tend to... They change slightly, but there's a brilliant crossover period in about the fourth series where you have Trevor Bannister and Ernest Bruff and Arthur English.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the imperial phase. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember being quite annoyed. All of us, I hate change. So whenever the new faces come in, the guy from the Blue Ribbon Dad and replaced. I remember being actually angry. It was one of the very. It was like a James Bond change.
And I watched one of Series 10 the other day. I'm sorry about this, Mike, if you're listening, you won't be. He's shit.
Yeah. It just doesn't
really,
work.
Really bad.
But you know
it's
what?
Also the dad in Russell Cummidge, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And Alfie Bass, he was contestant on the most recent series of The Voice.
Oh, that's right. So he was.
Yeah.
Did he sing the Blue Ribbon Blues?
No, he did not. Oh, thank you. When they spin the chair around, they should have with the Blue Ribbon Bash. Oh, thank you.
But he's got a nice British sitcom warmth.
He does,
but
they don't give him
that
yeah,
one.
No,
that
and they don't give him very much.
Trevor Bannister was awfully good.
He was
Why
great.
Did he leave? Did
well,
he didn't
yeah,
he
no,
right
no, no, because Trevor Bannister, when it's when Are You Being Served started, when Are You Being Served started, Trevor Bannister was the star.
Seriously?
Yeah, because he had just come off the Dustbin Men. Mr. Humphreys, John Inman, had literally had been working selling hats in Austin Reed.
Wow.
Molly Sugden was kind of, she'd been in Coronation Street and things like that. She'd been around for a while. Trevor Bannister was the actual star.
Right.
So as time progressed and they started giving John Inman more and more to do, he started getting huffy about it. And then he left.
That's amazing.
But then,
did anything else after that?
He did a lot of provincial touring. But you know,
I've got a poster in the house where he was appearing. I bought it online about 5 years ago, and he was appearing in like Clacton on Sea or something like that.
Or in Macbeth or something. Yeah. Trevor Bannister's Blinding of Gloucester.
Isn't Trevor Bannister in Ace of Wands or something like that?
Isn't
he dressed up in something weird?
I just need to tie this in.
Go on.
Go on.
He's in an episode of Steptoe and Son.
Is he?
He's the director.
Oh, and yes, your star is born. Yeah,
that's right, with a little necktie.
Yeah. But, so the time went on, but Are You Being Served as a Funny Series, because it was never properly commissioned by the BBC.
Really?
They never commissioned it and then said, oh, we'll just do this every year in the same way. They always had to renegotiate and try and convince themselves to do it again every year, even though it ran for, 10, 11 years. Yeah. So John Inman actually left at one stage, and they said, I'm not going to do it anymore.
Yeah.
And then, but went and made the really, really, truly terrible Odd Man Out.
Oh, you mentioned that. Yeah.
About the Rock Factory.
I don't remember.
In Blackpool. It's fucking terrible. But it was a flop, so he came back.
Is there a period where he's not in the show? Or
no. It's just, that's what I mean. They never had a regular schedule.
Right,
so
right.
They stopped making, they finished one series. He said, well, I'm going to get more money from LWT, and he's away. and then it was a flop, so he had to come crawling back.
Is that when Molly Sugden did Come Back, Mrs. Noah, and all that sort of stuff?
Or? Yeah, it was the same. It was the same.
That's thing. My
that's
boy.
I did like that.
There's a great line in this. It's a great call.
Do you remember my husband and I?
Yeah,
with William Moore, her actual husband. Yeah.
The only gigs, if you look him up on IMDb, the only gigs he has is with Molly Sugden.
He's in Coronation Street.
It's a great line there when the doctor says, we'll do a post mortem with me, and Hannah goes, nah, it's against his religion.
It's a seven days wonder. You've got to go back exactly as you went, as you came down. He says, well, I promise we'll put back everything exactly how we found it.
I like that, my boy.
This is a great sort of segue to get into the funeral stuff.
We're quite late into it now, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, we're getting there. The funeral sequences in this are just. my husband and I, possibly the last sitcom to feature somebody who is a head of personnel before the world went to shit when it turned to HR.
So, Mark, it's about time you gave us a showbiz anecdote.
Skeleton with
showbiz
a
anecdote?
Give us a showbiz anecdote.
About this?
No, any showbiz anecdote. Better than just me talking about Milo O'Shea.
Matt Strong, is he a nice fella?
Matt Strong, lovely actually, full head of hair in real life. shaves it for all the films. No, he would be my perfect Batman actually. I said, what are you talking about? And I was like, you've got Batman's face.
He tells us the nose for us, isn't he? He's
perfect,
got very Batman
perfect
nose.
Features
You're not
Batman.
Sold on the Batfleck then?
What's that?
You're not sold on the Batfleck then?
I just slightly worry about it. Like, the thing I like about Ben Affleck is that everybody hated him. I think it's our TV cream personalities, which is that we're contrary.
Yeah.
So, like, the minute everybody likes him, we have to go the opposite direction.
Yes.
So the minute I saw everybody attacking Ben Affleck, I was like, I love Ben Affleck.
I think he looks great.
He looks good as Batman and everything.
Hum.
My only kind of worry is everything else. Everything else in the film, I'm not sure.
That's reasonably large.
And can I just, if you're being quite diplomatic, Jesse Eisenberg looks fucking terrible.
Does he?
It just looks terrible.
I've got this theory that I remember hearing this years and years and years ago, that if you cast a baddie in something, he must be a more famous and more formidable person than the hero, so that subconsciously
Hackman.
The audience worries. Now, think of Christopher Reeve, nobody's heard of him.
Yeah, Gene Hackman.
Biggest
star of the day. Great casting.
So you always cast the, like, Ming the Merciless, you know, was.
Yep, Max von Sydow. Nobody knows who Sanjay Jones is.
So you always, the audience is subconsciously thinking, this hero I've never seen before has a real problem in his
And
I don't think that Ben Affleck does Ben Affleck have to team up with Henry Cavill to take down Jesse Eisenberg?
I don't think so, because you watch the trailer and you think why is Jeremy Irons not Lex Luthor?
There's a million guys it could be, isn't there? Like, he's playing the part of Robert Downey Jr. as Alfred, which is the weirdest kind of thing.
Yeah,
when
no,
he's wearing
totally,
purple
yeah.
waistcoats and sunglasses.
Yeah, he's wearing a sort of
Alfred.
Wee like combat jumper.
Yeah. I'll rub my irons. Jeremy Irons' greatest moment is when you've got an Englishman playing an East German, playing an American in Die Hard 3, when he goes, somebody had fun!
Henry Wolfe is excellent in Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's
Sunmakers. Yeah. Which is four episodes riposte to the tax system. Essentially what it is.
And a more elegant one than George Harrison's.
Yes, absolutely.
Don't want to pay tax. Pay tax, you scouse bastards.
You watch that trailer. No, this one, the most up to date Batman Superman versus whatever. And because the earlier ones were rotten. and you think, oh, that all looks really good. And then when that Eisenberg character turns up, so and there's the bit with the girl who I presume is meant to be like Lois Lane. That doesn't make any sense. And she's obviously called him, I think she calls him a psychotic, and he does this thing where he says, that's four syllables is too much for a tiny mind like yours, and he points her head. I mean, anybody else says, go fuck yourself. Give him a boot in the stones. I mean, it's like he's not got any superpowers.
Now, you're a big Frank Miller fan, aren't you? So The Dark Knight Returns is obviously...
Great singer.
...where they get all this. it was Dark Knight Returns, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But I remember reading that, and the whole point of that is that their feud is surrounded by all this other stuff with the psychotic gangs and all that sort of stuff, isn't it? The guys with the teeth and whatnot. And that's clearly missing from this film. It just seems to be the two of them fighting.
Well, the thing that's important, I think, with Dark Knight Returns is that it's the end. It's the tombstone on the superhero genre, where this is supposedly the beginning of a whole bunch of franchises, you know? So the idea that Superman and Batman were best friends who have this battle at the end, because one's a sort of stooge for the government and one's a radical anarchist, you know, Batman's out there in the streets, you know? And that kind of was really exciting. You'd never seen anything like that before. But see, just for kicking off a cinematic franchise, to see Batman and Superman meeting for the first time and they hate each other and all that, it's kind of weird. Like I say, my kids are obsessed with these characters and hate the look of it, you know, because they just want what's up with them just being pals? Yeah. Imagine the persuaders.
Do your kids know
what you should say?
Do your kids know what you do?
Oh, totally. They're obsessed with it.
Just a big butter and egg man.
Must be great, that.
What did we said in a previous commentary, one of them, shit-pot commentaries were done before, where we said, it was when Superman 3, because our friend Alan was in on it with us, and we said Batman versus Superman. So Superman will win.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you're setting up as the film. It's quite a win.
Well, Christopher Reeve made a really good point, because back in 1995, they were talking about doing this movie. Wolfgang Peterson was going to direct it back then. There was a script, I think, by the
director
who did seven. And Christopher Reeve said it's a stupidest idea I've ever heard in my life. He said one, they should be friends, they're both good guys. He says, and the other one, he says, Superman can move at the speed of light. Batman's just got a cool car. And it's a great point.
Absolutely.
He's a very cool car.
Right, how's this?
Here's a TV cream spectacular.
Oh, look at
me.
This is a Cream Guide Films.
It's a real treat.
Masterstroke of this crowd. Here they are. Open the door to Lenny. Neil McCarthy. Sam Kidd, George Tovey, and
Bill Maynard.
Is George Tovey any relation to Russell Tovey?
I have no idea.
Oh, I don't know.
No, I thought of that. I mean, look at that. What a bunch.
No, I'd only read this last night that Neil McCarthy, there on the right, suffered from acromegaly.
As did Andre the Giant.
Yes.
Callback!
Which, of course, is why he made a brilliant Calabos in Clash of the Titans.
Clash of the Titans, yep.
And he's also in Cat Weasel.
Yep.
Yeah. He's in Doctor Who as well, isn't he, Jack?
Clash of the Titans, another favourite in the Miller House.
Absolutely.
We watch it almost every day as well.
Exactly. Quite a lot of knockers.
Four films we watch almost every day. Jason the Argonauts is in there as well.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
Good films.
Do you know who's also in Sinbad and Eye the Tiger, actually? Peter Mayhew. But he's the guy who plays the giant golden...
Oh, the Minotaur.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
I think you call him the Minotaur in the movie.
Minotaur, on the back of the boat.
But that's Peter Mayhew. Who, weirdly, I hung out with for 2 weeks when I was in Australia about 12 years ago. I was hanging out with Batgirl and Chewie. It was the
Batgirl?
Yvonne Craig from the 60s TV show. We were doing a convention in New Zealand for a day.
See, when we asked about a celebrity story.
Why didn't this
you
come
didn't bring up your Angelina.
It was the most unusual sort of couple of weeks of my life, because it was the most random bunch of people put together. We had a convention in Australia, a convention in New Zealand, and the same people sort of own both shows, and you had 10 days to kill in between the two shows. And we all became really good friends and just hung out together. And so it was me, Chewbacca, the voice of Pokemon, you know, Batgirl, you know, just the most eclectic bunch of people.
Was it their official spokesperson?
She's now one of my closest friends. It was amazing. Been in Vietnam together. That's spent 2 weeks hanging out. So me and Chewie, me and Frank Whiteley, who's an artist, comic artist in Scotland, we just called Peter Chewie all the time, you know, and we felt
and
like
did he go?
Did he ever say human? Shut it! I was in Sinbad as well.
But the strangest day, it was like there was me and Frank Whiteley sitting with Yvonne Craig, who was Batgirl, and Chewie having lunch. Right, so we're all sitting around the table having lunch in a shopping centre, and Elton John genuinely is walking by.
No way.
And we knew that it was like a wave of fame that was coming from one end of this big place.
I can.
We're sitting having our lunch, and we just saw people all looking at each other and going, and this kind of silence, but like a Mexican wave of silence,
wow,
just coming up this place. And all they were doing was just walking and having a look in shops with a couple of bodyguards around them. And I'll never forget Chewie saying, "Fuck me, it's Elton John." You know, and you're Chewbacca, he should be impressed by you.
Exactly.
Being here, you
no,
know?
I can match that. I can match that.
Similar hair pieces.
Because upstairs in the canteen in the hospital where we work.
Uh-huh.
I once went upstairs and I saw a table that was populated
by... I saw this table as well. This is the best.
Sam Kane,
uh-huh,
Linda Lasardi,
yeah,
Vicky Michelle.
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, Christ, there was another one.
Come on.
Was it Peter Simon?
No.
And the last, but I can't remember the last one. And the last one sitting with them, Derek Jacobi.
No.
Do you know you've missed? Nick Cotton from EastEnders.
Nick Cotton, yay, that's right, John Aldridge.
That's a pilot for a sitcom that never got
table
commissioned, isn't it?
Well, what's great is that Derek Jacobi is clearly there to sit next to Vicky Michelle. Oh, Derek! Oh! Hello, right. I want to put something on record here.
Yeah.
In Jeremy Isaacs, or as my friend Peter would call, Wee Jeremy Isaacs.
Right. I once sold Jeremy Isaacs booze.
Did he know you had it?
No, he came into a pub that I worked in Edinburgh.
Jeremy Isaacs in his autobiography.
Yeah.
Has a bit of a dig at Aloha Lowe.
Oh, really?
Because he says that it was, in his opinion, a bit distasteful to have a programme about collaborators made on Jersey.
Yeah.
Which was the only bit of the British house that was ever taken over by the Nazis. It's not set in Jersey.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
it's set in Nouvion,
yeah,
on mainland France.
That's why.
Get your facts right, Jeremy.
I hope he's listening to this. Yeah.
And by the way, Jeremy, and by the way, you made mini pops.
Yeah.
you can't even point your finger at me.
No.
He doesn't mention that very much.
No.
His autobiography, does he?
Anyway, sorry, Craig.
I don't know, is it about Jeremy Isaacs coming to the pub that I worked
in? But talking about...
What did he have?
Well, that's the good bit of the story. It was a pub in Edinburgh that had a really big gantry full of lots of really, really specialty whiskies.
You have a pint of double
D. This is about 1991... No, about 1992, I think it should be, because I first worked there in the summer of 1992. And he came in during the festival, and I thought, oh, hold on, that's not Jeremy Isaacs. So I said, pint, son? And he said, no. He said, no, I have one. And what he had was...
Sorry, was it Bob Mills?
See, I've got an impression of Keith Richards that he says it's Bob
Mills.
It
just sounds like Bob Mills, doing it.
Hello, I'm Keith Richards.
Bob Mills!
That's because I'm fat. What he drank was, he was the only person who ever drank the 1936 Glenlivet whiskey.
Wow.
Right. Which was £15 a nip. And this was in 1992, when £15 was £15.
This is a lot of money.
You know what looks a great pub?
What was that?
The bar at the start of Carry On Abroad.
Oh, yeah.
Aye, yeah.
You know, it's Sid and Joan Sims' pub at the start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Looks like a great pub.
That'll be the reception area at
Elton. Think that all back together, of course. You've got the... we haven't talked about the film version of Are You Being Served, which I think is magnificent.
Well, you see, I'm not oversold on it. The bits that I like the best, there's two bits in it that I think stand out. The stuff at the start.
Yeah.
With the bloomers. Yeah.
The stuff at the start where they're in the
yeah.
store, where
yeah.
they're like filming the store, I think is beautiful.
Yeah.
And it looks really great. But the other bit that makes me, even though I really don't like all the stuff later, because I don't think that enough happens, but the bit that always makes me laugh out loud is where they're all sitting having dinner,
yeah.
all dressed up to the nines, and they've got to go to the outside toilet.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah,
they say like, you have to
yeah,
sing,
yeah.
yeah,
and they're all really pissed off. And I think it's Mrs. Slocum goes to sing and starts singing Nellie Dean, but when she sings, there's an old mill by the stream, and all the everybody at the table goes Nellie Dean.
with the wiggly wiggly thing in the tent.
But there's
well.
A callback, cultural
uh-huh.
callback. Because even us watching that and all that, then as now,
yeah.
we'd know what that song was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. yeah. Kids these days?
Kids today?
No idea. No
I
idea.
Remember watching
it's not
that
their fault.
Film. It was shown on BBC, it was about 1990, 91 at Christmas time. And I remember it finally because actually I came down with viral gastroenteritis on Christmas Day. I was really horribly unwell. My poor dad had a lot of mopping up to do. And then the next day, I think it was Boxing Day, they showed it at about 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
I remember lying in the bed, it was my first year at university, second year at university. I remember being back, well, I still depends, still lying in the house trying to watch it. And I was in such pain.
Basically
from
laughing
having
shit.
Been sick. I was worried about shitting myself. And I was in such pain in my
That'd
ribs.
That'd be a great vox pop for
that.
I was worried I'd shit myself.
TV Cream, bracket sitting next to Mark Miller.
Two thumbs up, Siskel and Ebert.
Mark Miller's
one arse open.
You know, we've...
It's, I tell you what as well, it's got an absolutely beautiful arrangement of the music at the start of...
Beautiful.
Oh, it's just immense.
Oh, of the Saturday...
Oh,
yeah,
of Are You Being Served? Kind of, yeah, it's incredible.
I need to tell you a quick anecdote, which, you know,
do
we're talking about... Yes, I do, yeah. Weird celebrity combinations.
Does it involve you nearly shitting yourself?
No, it doesn't. No, not at all.
It's not much of an anecdote.
Youth for Joyce is coming.
Phil Cunningham, famous fiddler.
No,
he's not.
Oh, no, he's
you've blown that
dude.
One already.
So famous accordion dude was...
I've got your pickled onions line.
He was at some big do at a posh country house, and he was outside having a fag.
Mm-hmm.
And some guy sat beside him, he didn't know who it was, right? First of all, he looked round, and it was Prince Charles.
Right.
And Phil was a bit worse for wear. And the only thing he could think of saying to Prince Charles was...
How's your wife?
No, he said, Your Highness... Do you get that Discovery Home and Leisure channel?
That's
To which Charles went, what is this? True.
Sorry, was he Russian?
Was it? Sorry, that's a good word.
What is this?
That's a
Discovery channel.
Home and Leisure.
I love the idea of the ultra glamorous. Next then with the commonplace.
Yeah,
one of my
absolutely.
Pals was telling me an anecdote.
That's you beating us tonight.
Like, you know Greg Hemphill?
See, when you say one of my pals was telling an anecdote, was it Angelina?
There was Greg Hemphill from Silk.
Yep.
He was
telling
me that his aunt works in Jenner's in Edinburgh.
Right.
And Sean Connery was in there on Boxing Day about 15 years ago or something like that.
Fucking
going
through the
shields,
Johnny, that.
He was going through the jumpers on his own with a cap on, just going through golf jumpers.
Mm.
And she was looking at him thinking, that's Sean Connery. And he was getting closer and closer. And he came up and he says, are these jumpers in the sale?
No way.
Genuinely, I mean, he's worth whatever,
Yeah, but he's a miserable bastard.
Are these jumpers in the sale? And she went, I'm sorry, I've just got to ask, you're Sean Connery, aren't you? And he went, yes, what of it, women? Are these jumpers in the sale? And I love the idea of him foraging for cheaper jumpers.
Oh, yeah, no,
I...
Something
to do with the
but there's some people you just imagine... Going everywhere by helicopter.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no,
and
absolutely.
He's one of those guys.
Yeah.
You don't imagine him at the
general
sale.
As long as David Murray's paying for it.
No, I like it if you spot people well out of context. I saw Larry David once in Ingram Street.
He's literally my. I watched two Cubs last night, two. Last
I don't know why he was there.
You saw Larry David.
I saw Larry David in Ingram Street.
Did you see Ingram Street?
Yeah, in town, yeah.
What was the con? What was going on?
He was just cutting up the street. I don't know why.
Was this just the golf guy?
No, but I did a double take pigeon.
Yeah.
But it was definitely him.
What year was this? I've got him.
Like 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh my God.
Remember I thought I saw Ian McKellen in the Marks and Spencers on Argyle Street?
Yeah, you did that.
There was a guy with a leather coat on and a hat looking like... Have you ever heard of the X-Men? So he was looking like, you know,
it's a kid's film.
You're a man from the X-Men. And he was walking away, he was looking through this guy. And I kept staring at this guy. And eventually he sort of looked up and said, hiya. And I said, has anyone ever told you? He said, yeah, that'll look like Ian McKellen. And I was basically saying, well, you could like dress less like Magneto.
Don't wear the helmet.
Wow.
Weirdly, I saw Servalan on a train.
Servalan on a train.
Or Frank Thornton.
Yep.
You and I were there a couple of years ago. Was Servalan one of the key...
No, not at all, actually. I found her a bit scary as a kid. You know, like, I think
that's
I was
right.
about
still
8 or 9 or something. And she had an air of menace that I probably it was too much for me,
oh,
you know. But
no.
My dad really fancied her. My dad used to watch Blake 7.
Yeah, you see.
So did my dad.
Yeah. Every
it's
dad
funny
dad
that because it was the only one of those programmes my dad would watch.
Aye, my dad liked her.
Go figure.
And what was she doing on the train apart from going somewhere?
She was actually eating an apple very theatrically. I remember it was...
I don't
think
she could do it otherwise.
But really over the top, like, kind of, like, as if she was going to say...
Was
behind you,
Fight was behind.
Oh,
I was at Blackpool Pleasure Beach, and we went on the Mouse Trap ride, which was terrifying. And I, unironically, halfway through, shouted, "Mummy!" Right? But anyway, when I got off, I was standing there, sort of
pulling
myself together. And then I sort of gradually became aware of what was going on around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of saw this vision of kind of turquoise.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw lots of kids running around. And then after a while, I realised it was Jimmy Savile.
No,
standing right next.
So how long
to
did it take you to come round?
Yeah, exactly.
You were probably safer on that.
Probably was. And my underpants were on back to front.
I do think actually it is entirely to your credit, Mr. Miller, that you're listening. you are the writer of X-Men and all that stuff. You've made all
you
these
do?
Films. And it's entirely to your credit. You're swapping several untrained anecdotes with us.
Several.
Fair play to you, sir.
Genuinely, if I meet modern Hollywood people, I just see them as people.
Do you tell
them
a story? Well, so I didn't know there was a train.
They're just folk that are working on something you're working on.
Just people you work with.
It's genuinely just like any job, you know. Mm-hmm. But see people from your childhood, it's magic.
Well,
yeah.
Put it
there is.
I have the same thing, sort of thing, you know? Because I remember... somebody told me, I remember somebody else telling me, like, oh, they play golf with Sean Connery once.
Yeah.
And all right. And then somebody I knew told me that when they were a kid, they once met Terry Scott. Like, whoa! Oh, what did he say?
I've got to
say,
the most impressive lineups I've ever seen in terms of celebrity. Uh-huh. This is like Mount Olympus, right? And mm-hmm. It's actually more like Mount Rushmore because it's these famous faces, right? I was at, Lucy and I were in a bar in New York about 3-4 years ago, and up at the bar, we were just sitting having a drink, and up at the bar, there was Adam West,
wow.
Gil Gerard,
uh-huh.
Wow.
Lee Majors.
And you even recognise Lee Majors?
And Burt Ward.
Wow, that's almost as good as
the legends.
Vicky Michelle.
That's
table,
almost as good. Yeah.
But, and they were all
but
just
Vicky
standing
Michelle
talking, and I was at a comic convention, I was there doing a signing, and they were in town for the same show, and these guys
fantastic.
Tour around a wee bit, not together,
wow.
But they'll just bump into each other occasionally, you know? Uh-huh. And so they know, they've known each other for years, they were all about the same age.
On the circuit.
And I remember actually just thinking, I'd love to say something, but dare I? You know, and I would walk up to Angelina, Brad Pitt, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's no problem, right? Because they're contemporary. But these guys, that's like Zeus
standing
there,
isn't
it? You know? So, and Lucy said to me, come up and say you're at the convention too. And I was like, these guys are talking about very important things. They can't have me interrupting.
At the bar. After a sci-fi convention.
What
do you think they're talking about?
Burt Ward's notorious memoir. I think we know what he was talking about.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling they were getting together to solve a problem that neither of them could solve individually as heroes.
That's right.
And they were coming together to sort that out for someone.
Wow.
So we should just actually start talking about famous people we've met. We met Small Daniels. God love him.
Yeah, good old Paul Daniels.
And Debbie McGee.
He kept trying to do tricks, didn't he? And
He was actually a magician, that's why.
You're trying to talk to the guy.
So Frankie Howard telling jokes.
Yeah. But whatever question you ask him, the answer is a story which he wins.
Yeah, he just tells stories that he wins.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
We met Dudley Sutton the same day.
Leave him alone, the man's ill.
He's a nice man.
Well, do you know, I'll tell you a strange thing with Paul Daniels. I love Paul Daniels, right?
Yeah, me too.
And I was reading the newspaper about a year ago, and it was an interview with him, and he was just
and
saying...
And did you rip it up and then...
pour some water into it.
And I'd just been to see the Edinburgh show. He'd appeared in Edinburgh doing the magic show.
Was that at the university during the festival?
Yes. I really enjoyed his show, and I was reading an interview with him, and he was just saying that his dream, his unfulfilled ambition at the age of 78, whatever it is, was to be in a Hollywood movie.
Right.
And his dad was a projectionist and a picture artist, you know, and he used to change the three reels. He was a kid who kind of moved the reels over and put the next one in. And he said he grew up with this, watching all these golden age people. He always wanted to be on the big screen. He says, it's my one ambition. He said, however long I've got left, I'd love to do it. My great sort of belief is, if you can do somebody a good turn, do them a good turn.
Right?
So I tweeted him and I says, listen, if you want to be in a big film, I'll stick you in a film, I'll get you in something.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, you serious? And I was like, yeah, totally, you know. And I sent my IMDb page, the show wasn't a nutter, you know. Uh-huh. And I fired this over to him. I said, look, I loved your stuff when I was a kid, if I can get you in something, you know. So I don't want to say what
is
the film
is.
Is he
going to be Kick-Ass 3?
Well, I don't want to say what the film is, because I don't know what's going to happen now. Oh, being second, you know? But what I did was I put him in touch with his big producer. So he's in a major Universal movie.
Yeah.
Fine.
Where he hasn't filmed it yet, which is
the
film itself starts shooting in about 8 weeks' time.
Oh.
And
there must be a way, man.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've been in touch with Debbie McGee.
I think I find that's going on, but...
The lovely Debbie McGee.
Don't
but
say
I would absolutely love it if he was healthy enough to appear in it.
Yeah,
you know?
That would be
because it would just, you know, just to have that sort of final, you know, happy moment for the guy, you know.
I hope it's like the Emperor in Return of the Jedi, you know, or Empire Strikes Back, like a fucking 30-foot high hologram.
Will
you have a bath with me after the show?
Hugh Jackman said he wants to give up the Wolverine.
Oh, hello! Oh, I'm raging, man!
My favourite actor on Paul Daniels was Tom Noddy, Bubble Magic.
The Bubble Man,
he used to do little square bubbles and he would smoke them.
Can you get away with that on telly these days?
Political
correctness.
What was the name of the guy who used to have those... What was the name of that guy that used to have those...
Hans Moretti?
No, not on the Small Daniel show. That American show, it used to crop up in the summer holidays.
Nixon?
He was the president. he had big hair, it was quite hippie-ish. Doug Hennings?
A magician?
Doug Hennings, a little bit creepy. It looked like he had cat AIDS. He was really... I think actually he did.
That's a sin.
Anyway, you used to get speciality acts on that.
Right.
But they were shit. Point being, British magic's better than American magic. Hans Moretti.
Yeah, Hans Moretti, phenomenal.
Speaking of which, Uther Joyce. There is a claim on Wikipedia that the word Uther is Aborigine for thirsty, which I think might be a cool joke.
Yeah, a cool joke, actually.
Because her decline was there for us all to see over the 70s, wasn't it?
The great thing about Wikipedia is getting in there and ruining it. Because I've done that. Sometimes
you do that to your page, because your page has got a really kind of oddly... It's like written by someone who's got a bit of a gospel thing going for you.
No, my page is actually about 6 years out of date. Because I got locked about 6 years ago. Because loads of people, like readers, would always go in and say I hated his new book and things like that. So it got locked about 6 years ago. So literally nothing I've done for 6 years has appeared on my page, which is really weird. Okay. But what I used to do quite a lot, I'd always just change one word and things just to change the meaning, I think, just if I was bored. You know, you're on a deadline and you think of something else, like when Benny Hill died or John Inman died or something like that, I'd always get in there and just try and confuse things by just saying, he leaves behind his wife and three young children now. I'd always just shove it in there just to confuse them. I'd always pick an affirmed bachelor from the 70s.
There's a great example of that the journalist Ian Martin, who to work at the Scotsman and all that, tells a great story when he was editor of the Glasgow Guardian newspaper at Glasgow University, and Pat Kane was rector.
Yeah.
And he got Pat Kane, you know, Pat Kane takes himself fairly seriously. God bless you, Pat. Coatbridge boy, isn't he?
Yeah, he's
lived
in
the corner. And he was writing a piece for them every week, he was writing a column, and they decided to change names in it. So he wrote one which was about the cultural critic Raymond Williams. But Ian changed it to every mention of Raymond to Kenneth. And he came hunting for him to try and get him to hide from him.
Sweet. What's happening in this film, Chris?
They're faking his death, but they put him in the coffin and all these people have piled round so that because they insist on a big tortoise funeral.
And he's
fallen asleep. Because it's so comfy.
But part of the subtext of this part of the film is that it's like a dying age, don't you think?
It's literally, it's not actually subtext, because Neil McCarthy said, Lenny says, you know, they're pulling down all the old yards, putting up them flats, none of the nippers going up on the plank, this is our last chance for a big tortoise funeral. Now this is worth paying attention
to.
What's
a tortoise?
Dragon Bone Man. Because as they're going round the streets, especially when they get to the high street, it's just phenomenal. And I think it has something in common with Diamonds Are Forever. because in Diamonds Are Forever, which is my favourite Bond film, when they do the chase in Las Vegas, and clearly they're just filming it in the street, because there's masses of crowds all standing and watching it. Well, when they get to the street here, there's millions of people just watching it. And watch out for the old boy taking his hat off.
Oh, bless.
Because they think, and everybody's watching it thinking it's an
they
actual
real,
tortoise funeral.
But look how good it looks. It looks fantastical, doesn't it?
What is the difference between real people and actors? Because you can tell. And they are still humans.
I think you should ask Brad that next time. Here, Brad, come here. I was talking to this boy, Chris, in
Glasgow. But you know the way that your eye can tell a CGI explosion from a really explosion?
Totally.
Yeah.
I think you can always spot
actors
a
in amongst
a real
ordinary
person
people.
Standing
around
compared to an actor.
Here comes the Pickford's van to push the plot along a wee bit any second now.
So why Diamonds Are Forever, Chris?
I just fucking explained that.
No, but why is it your favourite film? Why is it your favourite Bond film? You said it's the best Bond film.
Oh, because it's got everything in it.
It does have everything. Best henchman.
You missed the button shop front.
Yeah,
you've got
lovely.
To see it. The mosaic shop front.
Now, Mark, just to decide whether we
there
want
lay,
to...
There it is.
Oh,
that's for real.
Just to decide whether we want to have you in our gang, Mark.
Yeah.
What's your view on Moonraker?
Moonraker, I remember at the time actually being a wee bit disappointed because I'd felt Bonded peaked.
At the time,
and now I love it now.
But man,
as a kid,
like
I remember thinking, oh, he's getting a bit old. It's never going to top Spy Who Loved Me.
Sure,
you know,
I can see that.
The way I could tell Return of the Jedi wasn't as good as Empire Strikes Back, you could just tell something that happened.
But you know what I think about this is, we talk about this a lot, but the sort of this kind of, now this rather kind of high but his Spectre was much more a Bond film than anything else they've done recently, is that people seem to forget that if you've got the Bond box set, it's basically a library of films in one. So if you want a gritty one, I would recommend going into the Timothy Dalton period.
Yep.
But if you want something that's just a laugh, you can watch Moonraker.
Yeah, totally.
You know, I mean, you've got the whole range of films within them.
It is.
Depending on how you feel.
I
still think Spy Love
Me. Oh, this is an absolute... Here's this a good stunt.
Your favourite Spy Love Me?
Smack.
Pretty much, yeah.
Whoa.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a good film.
Oh, no, I'm down on that.
Why? Yeah. Oh, I like On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Why?
Actually, I'd say Tomorrow Never Dies is the... I'd say it's the third worst. Okay.
Which one's Tomorrow?
Tomorrow Never Dies
is the
terrible,
terrible
one.
Is that the
one
with
the worst?
It ends, isn't it?
And it's about.
It's terrible.
It's a film that's about a utilities contract. It's about switching your user. It's just bizarre.
Is Tomorrow Never Dies the one with the invisible car?
Yeah.
No, it's not. That's the one.
They all mash together for me.
Tomorrow Never Dies is the newspaper magnate.
Jonathan Pryce.
I don't mind that.
I don't mind that. Why is
he
the worst Bond buddy?
I think he's no threat.
Yeah, he's not much of a threat. You're all about the threat, Jack.
No, Jeopardy.
Jeopardy.
You need the Jeopardy bonds. Yeah. A great plan. The baddie needs a great plan.
And what about On Her Majesty's Secret Service?
I think it takes itself awful seriously. I like the idea that at the, you know, the getting married's quite a big deal in the Tellys of Alice.
Right, there's a couple of, sorry to interrupt, there's a couple of things we have to say here, we have to recognise. First of all, that's the same cemetery as Theatre
Blood.
And there's a thing, this is the early 70s, there's no
Jeffrey
Belden. There's no getting away, and it looks like David Owen carrying that coffin. There's no getting away from it. Everybody, and I think this is actually a quite subtle joke and actually not that bad, is that everybody who works in the hospital is black or Asian. But it's never... referred to, they never say.
I was thinking,
you know,
that last night watching this. There's no sort of racist.
They don't play it up or anything. Yeah. It's just everybody's black.
And also, they don't really try and make a joke at the fact that you could pretend that he's wearing a turban at that point.
Yeah,
well,
because
they do in the taxi though.
Right.
They do in the taxi, but actually, it's a taxi driver. So you know.
Do you like Theatre of Blood more?
I like all of those films. Even the ones that aren't as good, I'll still find something love in them.
Because it's the front of that, isn't it, where the horse goes by with Arthur. Is it Arthur?
No, Arthur's head comes off. It's who's the first one? It's Michael Hordern's body, isn't it?
No, Michael Hordern gets stabbed in the up against
it's
the plastic.
To it again.
It's that. Oh, I can't remember his name.
What's his name?
It's the guy whose name you don't remember.
Do you know what this Steptoe movie reminds me of a bit? Is interestingly, is Sweeney 2. Sweeney 2.
I love Sweeney 2.
Do you know that idea that those people said that Britain was in decline, everything was ended, and they were going to start up that new society for the family over in Spain? And it's a similar thing there, isn't it? You know, but it's the 70s and there's a sense of decline around, and they're talking about our old tinker's ways and all that.
But the thing is, it's also a world that seems very solid. You know, it doesn't, it's not like, it's not post-apocalyptic or anything. You know, it doesn't feel like it's about to collapse into the sea. It just feels very transitional.
The gap between rich and poor seems less than now.
Nobody's super rich now.
Yeah, you know?
That we are more unequal now than we were then, weren't we?
Yeah. Without question.
Well,
yeah.
Here's the thing. Here's the joke where he says, that'd be stupid. He's coming. My dad's been buried enough of that. He says, keep your turban on.
This whole business at the end here with the sort of horror film that it touches
is fantastic.
It's also beautifully shot.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's
beautifully paced with lovely organ music on it as well.
And Jeffrey Belden's great.
Jeffrey Belden playing
He doesn't have much to do in this.
He does at the end though. He has to pull the most immense
comedy
style horror face.
Yeah, and scream.
Sorry, what I was going to say is, if you made this now, not that you could make it now, but you know what I mean, if you added the sensibilities that exist now to then, somewhere in it would have to be a rich person. They would have to have somebody who was rich and appalled by how common they are and all that.
Yeah.
Whereas then it was just like, well, there's just a bunch of work. It's
and it's the wrong funeral.
It's the wrong funeral.
Now, you see, now I think that, the build up to that and that reveal there, that he's at the wrong funeral, Christopher Nolan fucking nipped that for the Dark Knight.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, the wrong one.
We mentioned in the previous, didn't we? You don't get that in films anymore. People running in and going, stop!
yes, when we were watching Condom Man. When was the last time a wedding was stopped in a film?
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
It just doesn't happen.
It used to happen all the time.
Here's the last question for you, Mark.
Yeah.
Do you know the link between The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises and Alo Alo?
Oh, I should put this on the thing. It's an actor, I take it.
Yeah. While you're thinking about that, I'd like to point out as well that he never actually stops.
He goes flying down there, doesn't he?
Okay, back to you, Craig.
Right, so.
The link is Christopher Nolan and Jonah Nolan's auntie is Helga from Alo Alo.
Oh, really?
Kim Hartman.
Yeah, Kim Hartman. She's
Kim Hartman's John Nolan's.
Another massive Nolan's crush of mine.
Oh, mine too. And my dad's.
Only as an actor.
No, sorry, you need to see this. It's the look on everybody's faces. Frankie Barra getting slapped.
Yeah, they all.
And they go, shut up, you silly kid.
Oh, this is
no, but look at. Just look at the way this is done, like.
Baildon is great.
Then Baildon sees Harold.
That's like the end of all the horror or something.
Wait, what you see? And the music on through the shut up, you silly
kid. Anyone else, that would be enough as your climax.
What you see?
And then they give you this.
Baildon's brilliant. That's a great
character. Wait, there's a lot. Look at his face. Climax, crescendo of the organ.
We could have stopped with the orgasm, but they gave the audience the multiple orgasms.
And how we get the denouement. You can cash the policy.
Nolan actually is my one showbiz anecdote.
Done a couple
when we were filming Wanted, it was 2007, and they were filming Dark Knight.
This is Chris, not Bernie.
they were filming Dark Knight nearby, and in Chicago,
right?
And one of my pals had written Batman, and he says to me, "Do you want to come over? Morgan Freeman's in this, and he's in your film as well." And I was like, "All right, brilliant. I'd love to come on the Batman set." And I came on, and Nolan was there, and they were filming the big scene where Bruce Wayne gives himself up and all this kind of thing, and like. There's actually two stories here. One is that Christian Bale I spoke to for 20 minutes, right? It was just he and I sitting having a donut and some coffee.
He wasn't just screaming at you about walking in front of him or something.
Couldn't have been nicer, a total gent and everything. And it was just he and I sitting while the other actors were doing something else, and he was just waiting. He had to go in for just a wee minute in this thing, right?
He's not dressed as Batman.
Not dressed as Batman, he's there as Bruce Wayne, right? And I was speaking to him.
Do you want a donut?
20 minutes, but he had an American accent, which I hadn't quite picked up on. You don't quite sort of pick up on this.
In the zone.
So subtle. And like, and then I said to him, "What part of Wales is it you're from?" You know, I just named chat, and he says, "Oh, I'm not from Wales. I'm from Guffington."
No.
And I was like, and it took me a wee minute. It was a real Kaiser Soze moment, where I suddenly thought, "Oh my god!" And I was thinking everything we've been talking about.
You're not actually
he was being Bruce Wayne for 20 minutes. Wow. He wasn't talking like Bruce Wayne. I was thinking everything we talked about, and he was talking about a ball he'd been at and everything.
You should have nitpicked him.
Give that a pause. That's a good showbiz
Did a tiny little bit of you think, what a fud?
No, I just felt really embarrassed. It was one of those things where I thought, oh, I've just been talking about real life. And that, you know? But then the double bad anecdote was I went over and Christopher Nolan's wife was pregnant with her last kid at the time, right? She was really heavily pregnant, but I didn't know. And I had a terrible hangover from the night before. This was a Sunday morning. She was sitting down in a seat, and I said, "I really feel terrible." I said, "I've just been sick before I come in. I'm so hungover."
Mm-hmm.
I says, "Is there a seat?" And she went, "You can have my seat." And I was like, "No, don't be silly. It's okay." And she says, "No, have my seat, please. I've got to get up anyway." And I didn't know she was like 8.5 months pregnant. So I just stood up, and I felt so bad. And I took her seat. I just sat down. But the final anecdote of that thing is I got to sit on the bat pod. You know, like the bat pod.
It
was parked around the corner at this bank where they were shooting this big scene, right? Mm-hmm. And there was nobody around. I'd said goodbye to everybody. I'd seemed quite professional, apart from the hangover and all that, you know. And I was heading off, and I was just leaving. And I thought, there's the bat pod. I'm never going to be on the Batman set again in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's around. Everybody's away around this big corner. And I climbed on there, and I sat on the bat pod, and I thought, I'll always remember this, you know. And it was so big. I remember sitting on it, and leaning forward. And then Christopher Nolan's wife walking around the corner and seeing me. And I actually felt like such a dick.
Did you go?
Because I really was just sitting like I was going to bed. And she says, "What are you doing?"
And I said,
I'm doing the aha video.
I just said, I don't know. Oh. And she said, you should probably just head off.
She was kind of embarrassed for me.
I can insinuate myself into that scenario.
Oh, I'm not at all surprised.
Hard to believe, isn't it? Right. When they were filming when they were filming, what was the last one? Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were filming bits of it in Glasgow.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Any bits in that film that looked really dark and shit,
yeah,
they were the bits filmed in Glasgow. And they kept all the... I live in the East End.
Yeah.
And they kept all the cars and all that in the old car market, which used to be the meat market in the Gallagher.
Yeah.
And one night, I was on the 62 going home from work, sitting there for like 40 minutes dozing off, and just somebody went, "That's a fucking Batmobile."
I actually was really worried that anecdote would end up with you clinging to Tom Hardy.
I'd still be clinging to him.
Craig, do you have any unattended bits of business?
From my little notes that I took last night. Oh, there's one. We didn't mention this at the time. Chris will know this. Mm-hmm. What is the name of the woman who would otherwise have benefited from the insurance policy?
Mrs. Eileen Pycraft.
What a great name.
Who the hell is Mrs. Eileen Pycraft? She was a very elfy girl.
Which gives them the chance to say,
"You dirty old man." So, in amongst all of that was Steptoe and Sunrise again.
Yeah, I think we quite enjoyed letting that pass us by while we were chatting.
And I think it's the proof that the greatest sequel that is better than the original is not The Godfather Part 2. Mm-hmm. It's Steptoe and Sunrise again.
Okay.
The original's a high bar, though, I think.
It's a great film, the first one.
The ultimate tragedy, that honeymoon scene, is one of the great dilemmas, isn't it?
And but it's not as funny as that one. When he goes into when he breaks in, you know when he's getting the shit kicked out of him in the rugby club and all that, and he breaks into the dressing room, and he realises that she's had a kid with the drummer and the band and all that, and it's just like it's a bit unbearable, to be honest. It doesn't have Johnny J, the Odin Groper, written on the lift.
Is there a modern day equivalent of that? I was thinking about this earlier today. I was thinking, like, you know that sort of slightly melancholic British comedy? It was almost like a play, those things, weren't they? They were really shot like plays.
Yes.
Is there a modern version? Like, Peep Show is kind of melancholic, but in a much slicker way. It's a different thing, isn't it? Is there a thing like this?
I think they're crueler, those ones now, and I think Ricky Gervais' stuff is crueler.
Yeah. The last one...
I think these films and these programmes that you're talking about love their characters a bit more than the ones do today.
The last one that did that in a big way was One Foot in the Grave.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where they could swap... Sometimes the gear changes didn't work, I don't think, but...
Yeah, right, because it would suddenly talk about maybe the kid that died.
Well, remember, there was the one where he's been the guy who was doing the garden has buried him up to his neck.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Margaret comes into the garden and she hears him and she lifts the flower pot and he's buried up. But then she has to say that her mother's died.
Yeah.
You know, I think that might have been the last one that did it.
Pathos. You don't get any pathos in.
Or bathos.
Or
porthos. Or Aramis.
1990 or before then, what do you think?
I think. I think so. You don't. I'm trying to think. What was the last?
Embarrassment came in,
isn't it? One from the Grave is probably the last.
Do you know what?
I think so.
Pathos, I don't think you really got an American sitcoms ever, did you? Mm-hmm. So I wonder. All in the Family. More international, just all so they could be sold abroad.
All in the Family had pathos.
I never saw that.
Yeah, because
did it ever get screened over?
No, but in All in the Family, like, because you know that was the Till Death Us Do Part version.
Yeah.
And like Archie Bunker's wife gets cancer and things like that. So they did introduce that. In a way, but you know, you're right. It's never really that big.
But now,
what sitcoms here are is embarrassment.
Yeah,
they make you embarrassed. It's toe curling.
But is that maybe just a decade long thing? Because I'm obsessed with comedy having a 10-year phase.
Right.
Like, you know, like the '50s, you had the Goons and it was absurdist. You know, then you had the '60s and it was like Frost and hard edge political satire.
Yeah.
Then the '70s and you're back to the surrealism or the Monty Python and everything. The '80s it goes hard again. You've got the kind of you know, Ben Elton and those kind of guys.
Uh-huh.
90s, you're back to absurdism with Vic and Bob.
Uh-huh.
And then it's the darkness of League of Gentlemen and you know, Ricky Gervais and that's at harder edge. And Michael McIntyre just seemed to come in at the end of that in 2010. So it went from dark to ultra light.
That's when comedy died.
But what do you think this decade's comedy then is, if those others... I mean, I guess it has to be something light, but what's What's the big comedy of the noughties? Because we're more than halfway through it.
Is there anything at the moment that...
I don't know.
You've got the absurd stuff like Toast and whatnot on Channel 4, but that's always at the margin.
But you're never taking
but
off.
You're talking
but your mainstream stuff's
these,
like Miranda and things, isn't it?
Yeah, which is kind of silly and quite throwback.
But to go back to what we were saying earlier, the callback, there is no shared experience of a programme in the same way as there was before anyway.
But the noughties definitely had the shared experience of the dark embarrassment.
Yeah. Yes.
Whether it was Larry David over in the States or Ricky Gervais over here. Yeah. Or League of Gentlemen kicked it off with 1999 real darkness coming into comedy.
Yeah.
But people don't watch everything together.
Yeah, that's the point, is that even in the last 5 or 6 years, I think there still was enough.
You're right, because there's Netflix and all that.
Aye, Netflix, iPlayer, all that has really changed it.
So now you can just watch it all in one go.
So now there isn't. It's the same as music, I guess. I mean, music, you had 55, 66, 77, 88. You had a paradigm shift going on, didn't you? And then nothing arrived in 99, like Acid House and all that kind of thing in 88. Mm-hmm. And then nothing
arrived.
It's
funny you should say it, because there's just somebody on Facebook, there's somebody I know today, had posed the question, in years to come, what will people say between about 2002, 2003 and now was the, when music happened, that has changed everything?
I'd
nobody
say,
could think of anything.
I'd say since the early 90s, there's been nothing really.
Well, that's just the point.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just because people consume
things.
Are
we just getting old?
No, because I think
I'm 14.
But kids don't dress. The way that punks or hippies or anything like that, but are a cultural movement, kids don't dress.
Well, grunge might have been the last one.
You know, so...
Anyway, let's draw the seminar after
a it ends up with young lassies using the C word and cutting folks' arms and legs off in films. And I hope you're proud of yourself.
I hope you're happy with that.
Do you know, if that was someone else, I'd be the first person to be complaining about it.
Right, come on.
Okay, cool. So it's thanks for listening. Thanks to Superstar Mark Miller.
Wait.
And it's Showbiz Anecdotes.
We'll
3-1
Yeah,
3-1
Bye, everybody.
Bye.